How is everybody doing? Yeah. Everybody sleep okay? So just a couple more housekeeping things. So we'll try to invite the bell 10 minutes before each activity as best we can. So that's an invitation to slowly stop what you're doing, put your things down, and mindfully make your way to the next activity so that we can be ready together for the next activity. And we can have that opportunity to prepare ourselves for what we'll do next. That also includes if you need to move the chair to make yourself comfortable or set it up in a way that makes yourself comfortable. You can do that before we invite the bell in here for the activity. So we really try to create a space of calm and ease. Similarly, when we're eating, when we sit down, it's even if we don't invite the bell in 15 minutes to start to have quiet conversation, we can try to sit for 15 minutes with the food before we stand up and go and get hot water or have seconds or finish our meal. And again, the idea is to have a period of time when it's quiet. So there's not moving around, there's not setting up the chairs. As we're sitting down or standing up to go get something else, we're not heating anything up. But for 15 or 20 minutes, can we have some silence while we're eating? So we can really hear ourselves chew. You should be able to hear the person at the end of the table crunch on a carrot stick. That's the silence that we're looking for. So this is our first full day, and we're gonna coming out the world. It'll take time to actually recognize what that silence means and what it is and how it benefits us. And that's why we're going to practice together. So we're heading in that direction. So the little reminders are just to help us know that's where we're heading. The bell is really the bell of mindfulness. It brings us back to ourselves. So when we're in conversation or reading or eating, the bell. So let me get ready for the next activity so I can be fresh and present for that next activity. Because what we create together is what's going to heal us. I am not going to heal you, Sister Peace. I don't think she thinks she's going to heal you. But the container that we create together with the energy of intention, that's what's going to bring the energy of healing. And so everyone participates in the container being created. And it's truly what you bring to the space. And it doesn't mean you bring only calm and ease and joy and all that. No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is if you bring an intention around getting still so you can see what's there to be healed, this is the container we create so we can all benefit from it. So you're contributing, your energy that you're bringing in is dropping off. I like to say that it's like raindrops coming off a petal. That's what we're doing, our energy. We got little droplets of energy popping everywhere. When we walk, we're dropping it. When we're moving our hand, we're dropping it. Even when we don't intend to drop it, we're sharing our energy in this space. And this is why it's so important to become aware of who we are, so we know what we're bringing into the space, how we're contributing to this earth and to society. What are we bringing into the world? What are we leaving in every space that we occupy? And so when we come into retreat together, we make an intention to be in a space where we can heal And we all take responsibility for our healing. The magic is created by the collective. No one will drop that magic on you. It's not like that. Our healing is collective. And what we bring to the collective is the individual work that we do. And that's why the retreat is called Healing Ourselves, Healing the World. Because it's so big, and then it's so small, because it starts with us. Another housekeeping thing is, the phones. I know, we like our devices. And the devices, like Sister Peace said yesterday, is a help. And so the invitation is to make a commitment to yourself with the phone. It's your commitment. You don't tell me or Sister Peace or sign it up there, and no one's gonna be checking on you and tapping your shoulder. So it's your commitment to yourself of how often you wanna use the device while you're here. We really invite it not into the meditation space, not into the shared spaces, because again, what we're bringing in that space affects the community, collective. sometimes we suggest you commit, maybe you'll check your phone twice a day, maybe in the morning and at night. We know you have family and children and partners and responsibilities at home, and so there may be a need for you to check in or things like that. But we really invite that you are mindful and see how you can leave the device and maybe even leave it off while you're not having it on you, and turn it on and check it. And you'll be amazed how long you don't have to charge it. When you actually take it off, because it's off. So that's, again, just a reminder for how you want to practice and your commitment to yourself. I wanted to talk with you today about what's going on in the world. And no, we're not going to bring the election and all that into space. But we certainly don't leave it outside, right, when we come into spaces of practice and spirit. So when I say I want to talk about that, what I mean is I want to talk about how we are in the spaces that are going on around us every day. It's a really challenging time in society right now, particularly for people in marginalized spaces, right? And so how do we meet these difficult spaces with hope, with love, with compassion, with inspiration? How do we stay true to the core of who we really are, even when we're in this, it's like we're swimming in stuff all the time, right? We walk out the street and it just starts, or it continues, I should say. So, or even in our home sometimes, because we have to remember that just as everything is impacting us and we're trying to negotiate that in a generous and kind way, it's happening with our family members too, our roommates, our partners, our friends, our classmates, our work colleagues, the person riding the bus with us, the person who is taking their time crossing the street when we're in a hurry to get somewhere. So the same things we're negotiating, they're negotiating the same things. And so how do we keep remembering that? That this dive that we're in right now, because in a way it's a dive, it's like we're in, we keep coming up, you know, for air, like this is coming up for air right here. This is like, and remembering. And then it's a dive again. And so how do we remember that we're all unfortunately swimming in the same water? And so everyone is taking care of themselves in the best way they can, and we are taking care of ourselves in the best way we can. And when we practice, we actually, we become almost a little magnet, a little lightning rod, if you will, because we're creating more space in ourselves, and then we can also offer that spaciousness outside of ourselves. And so even though our sisters and brothers, our siblings outside, may not have had the good karma to have touched spaces of invitation for healing like we have, if we are healing, that's the gift we automatically offer them. So every one of you, you're already on the path of a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva in Buddhism means someone who is practicing with the intention of helping everyone find their freedom and their healing. That's what a bodhisattva is. You can acquaint it to maybe a saint in Christianity and other traditions. And so because we have, it's actually, we're blessed. We're here. It's Thursday. It's Friday, right? The world keeps going. You know, we saw the light rail passing by this morning. Life continues on. And yet we have accessed a path that has given us the insight that taking time and being here is necessary for our healing and the healing in the world. Now that is good karma. We all did something good in a past lifetime or previous lifetimes. One, to be human, to be reborn as in this form, and two, to have touched the Dharma, to have touched teachings that awakened us to something else that there is to do in here. And three, you've touched it so deeply that you're here. You've taken the time out your life, your day. Some of you I know practice continuously. Some of you have been to our retreats before and other retreats. And so you keep touching the Dharma. You are awake enough and you have been blessed and have karma that keeps bringing you back to this path of awakening. Just that we could be celebrating if we could keep remembering it. And then we are intentioning along this path. We keep continuing along this path. We keep looking, we keep listening, we keep thinking, how do we keep practicing? How do we keep waking up? How do we come back to that place where we know there's something different, something more beautiful, something more noble, something we keep aspiring to? And in those moments when we touch it, and it's clear, it's crystal clear, we have no doubt. And then there are moments when our faith falters and we get touched by the world and others around us who haven't had the karma and haven't had the benefit of touching practice. And then sometimes we get swayed by that and we start moving toward that again. And so then what is it that we do to remember again and come back on that path? And in this world that we're negotiating, because there's so much out there that's pushing us into this place of desperation, pushing us into places of violence, really. Because when we start responding with violent words and thoughts, even if we don't say the words, if we're thinking, you know, when that person does that thing or says that thing, and that word and that automatic habitual response is not kind, that's we're off our path. We are off our path. And though we think we may be righteous to respond in that way, because they did just call us this, and they did just treat us like we're this child of so-and-so, how do we respond to those times in this kind of world? When we hear the current sitting president say the things that he says on such a large scale, how do we not, when we read those tweets, what do we do with that? Like, how do we not go to anger? How do we not go to revenge? How do we not go to when that mind slips into it, someone needs to kill him? Right? Right? Am I making that up? No. So when, that's the kind of things that we're faced with now. We're faced with such violence that it triggers the most violent response in us, unknowingly, unconsciously even. And so this is what we mean when we say violent. It touches the buttons of violence, and it can easily just go into that rabbit hole of violence. And so it does become our responsibility. I know you came here to retreat and relax, and we're going to do all that. And in that process, we're going to remind each other that because we have been blessed to be awake, we have a responsibility to stay awake and to help others not go back to that place of violence. But first, to help ourselves not go to violence. Because it's so predominant. I'm in spaces and with people who sometimes I hear things out of their mouths that I'm not sure what happened. But I do know what happened. Because we're swimming in it. And so those of us who have touched this path, those of us who have said we want to wake up, those of us who know there's something more beautiful than what the social construction is that we live in day and day out, because we have started that path, we do have something beautiful. We have a jewel already. And so how do we share that jewel with others? And I know we feel, it's a burden to wake up. But it's a burden only if we look at it within the context of the status quo. Because then what we do, so let's take race, right? So as a person of color, when a white person is treating me the way they've been socially taught to treat me, if I put myself into the caricature of I've been oppressed historically and marginalized, and now you want me to teach you how to behave, white person, it's another burden, perceived as another burden, right, within that construct. But if we can lift ourselves out of this construction of dualism, us and them, and remember that we've been touched with this awakened nature, then the responsibility is, how do I continue in this path of awakening? So when that white person is insistent in treating me like this little brown, black person, what do I do? How do I not react? Either take the role on and just be that little person that has been historically appropriate, right? Appropriate, so we all get along. Or how do I not react? Go to reaction and revenge? So if we believe that we're awakened and we're on this path, then we know that neither one of those reactions or responses is going to be how we move in this world. This is when it becomes our responsibility. And I'm not saying it is our responsibility in this construct of race to teach white people how to behave. What I'm saying is that it is our responsibility as awakened people to stay awake, even when someone in front of us is still asleep. Do you understand that? Do you understand the distinction? Because I think especially in justice movements, we kind of have this ideology that I'm not teaching white people how to eat. I mean, I've said that and done that myself. But that's stuck in the status quo. That's stuck in this dualism. That's stuck in this way of thinking that somebody owes me something. And if we keep holding on to this, people owe us stuff, what drives that is the pain. And the only way, and some of you may not agree with this, but I invite you to listen to it. The only way you can keep thinking that somebody owes you something is to have a focus of pain that it's tethered to. And sometimes I find that we hold onto that pain so tight that the natural response is to look for repayment. But that once we start to heal that pain and that nidus, that focus, that tension, that knot starts to open, there's something that happens where that string that was tethered to the pay me this, you owe me this, I'm not teaching you anything, all of a sudden that loosens. And now we're coming out of a different space. It's a new space, it's a fresh space. It's a hard space to negotiate because it's one where historically we haven't had, because so many of us are not free and so many of us have been negotiating from places of not being free. But when you start getting free, and that's when we start opening and healing that space, then you start losing that tether that keeps you locked into that old way of engaging with the world. And with the whole world, I'm using race as a particular example, but this engagement comes with the whole world. So our heart gets big, we're more spacious. Sometimes we don't even know where it comes from. Sometimes I do things that I'm wondering, why did you just do that? Because the old me would not act like that. The old me would be like, oh, yeah, right. And there'd be all kinds of stories going on in the mind, and I would be completely justified. I would convince myself that this person just did this, it's crazy, history, I can run all the data. And I would feel very comfortable sitting there saying or acting in a certain way. Sometimes now I act out of my heart. And later when my mind and my little brain catches up, it asks my heart, why did you just do that? And sometimes it takes a while for my heart to explain to my little brain, because the little brain's behind the heart. So I see some heads nodding, and I just wonder, so you understand what I'm saying, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is the awakened nature, and it comes and it goes. It doesn't, at least for me, it doesn't stay all the time. I wish it would. I'd be a much more fun person to be around with all the time. But when I get back into my other self, the self that has been socially constructed, I'm not a nice person to be around, because I'm back into moving from my history, my perceptions, the pains that I bear and that I haven't healed, that I feel someone owes me because it hurts so bad, and someone like you caused it, so I'm gonna take it out on you. Even though you didn't do it, but you look enough like them and you're part of that whole history of them. And so it's okay for me to expect you to know that I hurt because of something your great-great-great-great-grandma did to my great-great-great-great. that I still hold that pain. Because I'm not denying that I still hold that pain that my great-great-great-grandmother had. It's right here. It's all in me. It's still there. I take care of it every day. It's all over me. The thing is, as we wake up and we heal this pain, are we able to let it go not only in the body, in the heart, and the mind catches up, so that those perceptions that we have crystallized into rock formations actually starts to open up. And then the next thing you know, we actually engage differently with people. And those are the times when you're not really sure what happened. At least I'm not sure. And people look at me who know me for a long time and they think something's wrong with me. You high? I am high. But I'm high on something different now, right? I've been high on other stuff, but this is a high that lasts a long time. This is a high that that's already here, it's inside, and it's something that I can actually control. So so I want to so what I'm saying is that we're both walking this path. Sometimes one step we're awake, and the next step we've gone back to sleep. And the next step we're awake, and like and sometimes when we have like we have times when big things happen and we completely lose our practice. And we might spend a few days like forgetting that we ever were able to hold a breath and be aware of it. And so those are days when like all of the steps are kind of coming out of craziness, because the pain is so great, and because we've forgotten ourselves, we've forgotten who we are. And when I mean who we are, I mean this awakened nature that is inside of us always. And then we remember to breathe, and then we slowly make little baby steps, and then we're kind of back again. And that is all normal. How many lifetimes have we been doing this? We have so much generational trauma in us, just historically as folk of color. That's just one. That's not talking about female identified bodies. That's another one. It's so much. And so to think that we can come to a retreat or two retreats or even 5 years of retreats or 10 years or 20 years of retreats, and each one of those steps is going to be a step in awareness and awakeness. Well, I think it's that holding ourselves to these very high standards that almost a self-punishment, if you will, a societal self-punishment that we've so taken in that we don't even know that it's not our own way of treating ourselves. We're so used to treating ourselves badly and harshly, and we think because we are able to critique that we're smart. So I remember I went to I keep remembering things that are getting recorded now. Oh well. So I went to grad school at Hopkins, and I was in the PhD program. And I will never forget this. So you know, Hopkins is a big research institution. And I went to Hopkins because I wanted to understand how people who didn't look like me behaved. I was very intentional. Because, you know, it's a place that doesn't have a lot of people who look like us. So when I got accepted to grad school there, I had no idea. My upbringing is very interesting. Like, I never wanted to go to college. When I finished high school, I joined the Air Force. I was, you know, I was kind of in that track where no one thought I was smart, so, you know, that way. So I went, you know, I was in the Air Force at 17, 4 years in the Air Force. And then I went to, finally went to college during Air Force, because it was so terrible in the Air Force. They really let you know who you are. And then I realized, since I didn't have wealth, that the only thing I could do to move around in this social construction was to go to school. So I went to school, and I did that for a long time. So I was in a master's program in New Mexico, and the one of the professors said, "Oh, you should go do a PhD." And I was like, "Well, what's that?" This is how clueless I was about education. It really was not my thing, because I wasn't taught that, you know, like. It's kind of that whole way that we come up sometimes. So they told me I should apply to the big schools. So I had no idea what Johns Hopkins was. And so I came here, this kind of brash person, thinking, oh, this is where all the rich white people, they go. Oh, I should go investigate this. 'Cause those kinds of investigations, that I was very clear on very early in my life. I always was told, and I knew where I was supposed to be and where I wasn't supposed to be. So when I was told I should go to a place where I wasn't supposed to be, I was very curious, and I wanted to figure that out. So that's really the reason I went to Hopkins. And then while I was at Hopkins, going through all this stuff, what I was taught was, the best researcher was the most critical thinker. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then they went on to tell me what critical thinking was. Critical thinking was if you could tear the other scientists apart. I was so impressed. Not. Because this is antithetical to everything that I believe in from when I was a child. My grandmother did not teach me that. Those were not my values. So when we're in these places where society keeps telling us this is how you're supposed to be, and we allow ourselves to be formed by that. So that was a pivotal point, right? For a mind that's very open to this world of history telling us who we are, how we should be, one can easily go into that world and just agree. And I saw many of my colleagues do that. But it was very funny to me, because I thought, this is crazy. You're going to tell me by treating someone bad so they look bad and someone turns red standing up in front of talking to everyone that that's a good thing? So this is I give that as an example of this is how we've been constructed. This is what we are meeting. And as we move through the world and we meet things like that, and that's kind of in a not so challenging environment, right? But it is violent. That is violence. Don't make any mistake about it. When someone tells you that the way you can excel is by putting someone else down, that's violence. That does not live us up to our highest humanity. That does not negotiate our truth, that heart space I was talking about. So this is an example of how we have continuously been shaped and formed and molded. And so today, when we meet violence, sometimes we don't even know it's violence. And in the world that we're living in today, where violence is coming in very different forms now, it's very easy to fall back into those places, because we've been schooled from very small to very tall that this is the way to be. So I started by saying, how do we meet fear, anxiety, anger? All these things, the violence, like, how do we meet it by staying in understanding, in love, in compassion? And I'm going to pass this some cards around and with some pens. And I'm going to invite everyone to, this isn't an essay, y'all. I want you to just think of a situation in the last weeks or so of when you can, of remembering when you met something, one of those situations that was violent towards you, that was painful, that hurt you, that triggered your anxiety. I want you to write down how you responded. So this is part of our path. Our path is we investigate. We investigate so we can see clearly, and we practice with mindfulness. So we're going to start that path. So this isn't to judge yourself, punish yourself, judge yourself as a violent person, a bad person. This is to start to stop and take the time to look to see how we are and how we behave with the most gentle, loving, kind lens. The lens that is a lens of our practice, a lens of being awakened. So basically what I'm saying is, remember a time when that footstep was maybe in sleeplessness, in sleepfulness. And just a couple words, what can you remember? So you write it down, and then you'll do some reflection. You'll try to remember, you'll try to trace why you responded that way. Like if it was anger or sadness or anxiety, can you trace back what triggered it? Was it fear? Was it shame? Was it feeling no control? Was it a desire for something that you think should have happened but didn't happen? Like, this is our path, is really investigating and understanding why we act the way we do, so we can decide if we want to keep doing that or not. But there's nowhere that we're going to transform our suffering if we don't understand what our suffering is, right? So I'm going to pass these around. Please take one each. Please, thank you. And this is maybe like 5 minutes, okay? Is it clear, the invitation, is it clear? One more time, okay. So I'm asking you to remember something, a situation, an engagement. It could have been with a group of people, with a person on the street, with someone you love and care for, where you felt fear, you felt something violating you, hurting you, and how you responded to that. Especially, I'm thinking of that moment when you responded back with fear, when you responded back with anger, when you responded maybe back with hatred, when maybe you responded back with shame or greed. But can you just note that? And then after you write it down, because now you're bringing it to mind, right? You're bringing it back up. After you note that, then close your eyes and take a moment to try to trace the path from, so let's say I responded to anger because someone said something mean to me. But what was behind the anger? Was it hurt? Was it a sense of loss of control? Was it a sense of shame? Was it fear? Was it, I have a perception of who I am and this person just did not treat me like that? So just trying to trace where it came from. You might even be able to trace a place in the body if you were aware, maybe you'd notice where in the body when that hurt came or that violence came. And that violence could have been a word said to you, or even a look toward you. It could have been you went to get your favorite beverage and your partner took it, right? Because these are the kind of little mundane things that happen where we actually water those seeds that we want to look into. And you're not going to show anyone this, and you're not even going to share it out. I mean, I might ask a couple people to share it if they choose, but this is for you to start noticing. So after you write, just put the pen down and the paper down and start coming back to your breath. So let's do that together. Put the pen and the paper down. And let's come back to the breath. So we're aware of the breath coming in and the breath leaving the body. And with that breath in, just notice in this exercise, notice that sensation, that emotion that you reacted or you responded with in that moment of feeling hurt or violated. And as you keep breathing, keep noticing where it might have come from. As you keep creating that spaciousness and that stillness, notice what you see in that same situation. And this is a gentle, caring seeing. This is not a punishment. This is not a bad person. This is a looking to see clearly, to discern how we behave. And as we keep breathing, maybe we even can get in touch with the area of the body as you're thinking about this. Do you notice any area in your body that maybe you notice some heat or a tightness, a heaviness, pain, cold, vibration, numbness. so you can open your eyes. So this exercise that we just went through, for some of you, this may happen instantaneously when you're engaging with people. For some of us, the exchange might have happened, and then later at night when you're about to relax or you're sitting, or the next morning, it might all come up and you might notice what we just went through. There will come a time as you continue to practice where in the moment that that happens, all that you just did is going to happen right then, right there. Because it's in that moment when you notice right then that you decide whether or not you're going to do the same thing. It's in that moment when you see so clearly that the time, that point in time seems to elongate in the mind. And you see where it's hurting, you see that, oh, this is a trigger from that old time. This isn't really about this person. I'm really agitated already because something happened this morning. I don't need to respond this way. And then the response, all that's going to happen, and then the response that's going to come out is a different response because of that reflection. Or the response might be the same, but because of the reflection, it comes from a different understanding of why you may be saying the same thing you said. So the awareness doesn't necessarily change the action. The awareness changes the understanding. And sometimes the understanding will result in a different action, but not necessarily. So let's just take about 5 minutes to see, does anybody want to share? Maybe a couple people out. And if you don't, that's fine too. Just an opportunity to. Please.
Experience was intense rage and frustration on my part. And I recognized the disabling impact that I was experiencing. I recognized that my rage and my frustration was diminishing my own power and my own agency in each circumstance. I was at a loss as to what to do with my feelings. During this exercise, I was able to trace back where in my life I had experienced those feelings. You know, we're all 7 years old, actually. I can't say for sure why my response was I needed to show myself as being correct, right, or to show myself as being, as needing to justify myself. Like there was a demand upon me to justify myself. Say for sure why that was my response. I can now see that when this kind of opposition comes into my space, I think I will at least be able to recognize it as something out of my history. And it might give me some additional capacity for just breathing through it, recognizing that there is a place for it, for there's a place for that kind of opposition, and that I might be better served by just being an observer as opposed to an opponent.
Thank you. So, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate what you said about not sure not of what you wanted. in our teachings, in the Buddhist teachings, there's this a perception that we're striving towards something, an image of who we are. We have this idea of who we are. And often anything that deviates from that sets us on this path of striving. And so in some way we're striving toward this caricature of who we should be. And that who we should be is made up of what society has told us we should be. And that's hard. It's hard on many levels. It's hard because it's a society for black and brown bodies that, number one, doesn't like us very much. And so there's a narrative of who we are and could and can and should be. So there's a striving toward that. That sometimes hasn't touched who we really are already in all our beauty and wisdom and full capacity as is. And anything that takes us away from that striving of holding onto that caricature of who we thought we should be or who we ought to be in order to really show the world who we really are, it sets us on this path. So when we actually finally react from that hurt, and we can find the space to trace where it's coming from, we might find that it's coming from some place that we have in our mind who we should be. And this understanding in Buddhism that we are already who we ought to be, all of a sudden it just opens it all up. And then if we let that all go, it drops all the perceptions, and all of a sudden in that moment we can actually be fully present to what's going on right in front of us, because we're not holding on to that image of what should be. We're fully fresh, and we can actually see so clearly, this is what's going on now. Okay, this may be how I'll respond now. But as long as we have all these veils and these caricatures of how it should be, how I should be, how they should be, this is what gets us bound up. What we call bound up in views of what ought to be and what ought not to be. And so if we can drop all these, this bubble of perceptions and views and preconceived notions of what's right and what's wrong and how I should be, then all of a sudden we're not striving for that anymore. And we can fully be in the moment with what is and take care of that. And we're taking care of that from some precepts, right? Some mindfulness of not hurting, not stealing, not lying, not intoxicating. So we have these precepts that we hold in mind. We drop all the tethers that hold us into this bound small self. And with those precepts, we can be fully present to respond in that moment from freshness, from brightness, from wisdom. That's our wisdom right there. In that moment, one wise self. Thank you very much. No charge, just like that. And I make light of it because it kind of gets like that, right? If we keep doing it over and over again, it's like, oh yeah, how can I take, I can't take this too seriously. And I wrote these five words up here just to remind us that there's a trust, there's a faith that we have in our path. We do have a faith. We're here because we trust that something is good is happening to help us take care. And then we put the energy into it. We'll do it. We put the effort, right? We practice with mindfulness, and mindfulness keeps us remembering our precepts. It remembers to stay fully present. That's why we're practicing mindfulness. As I'm walking, as I'm talking, as I'm eating, as I'm smiling, can I be aware of what I'm doing? And when we practice mindfulness, it automatically leads to concentration. It's not like, okay, now I'm practicing mindfulness, now I'm practicing concentration, and now I'm practicing insight. It really does not happen this way. But when we talk and teach and share about it, it's easier, you know, to, unfortunately, sometimes to put things into little boxes so we can get an understanding. But don't leave them in the box. Just remember, it's the box, the little boxes is just to help us capture the understanding. And then once we understand it, let the boxes open and understand that all this is happening all together simultaneously. So I'm going to close with something that just happened in a group that I'm involved in called Volar, Village of Love and Resistance. We're a black and brown led cooperative about taking back land. It's a big issue in the country. It's certainly a big issue in Baltimore. And so we've been negotiating to buy this 17,000 square foot building. Hopefully when we get it and renovate it, future retreats will be there. And we met some resistance from the church remembering now, we recorded. And we're still negotiating for this building, right? So we met some resistance from the church. All of a sudden, we weren't the best buyer, even though we had been for some reason. It changed. Well, not for some reason, there was another buyer. And so a lot of the things around perception of who we are as a Black and Brown collective was there, right? Especially if the other buyer is a wealthy developer in the city that typically does development as usual. So, you know, we had some feelings about this. But we didn't lose feeling powerful. Even though we don't have a lot of money, we do have enough money cash to buy the building. Cash, y'all.
Good.
Right?
Yes.
17,000 square foot, y'all. Big building, lots of money. And yet the seller wanted us to prove we could renovate it. So there's all kinds of typical stuff going on here, but maybe not recognized by the seller, because not everybody's awake, remember? And remember, this is why we have to stay awake, so we can help them wake up, right? So we wanted to meet to talk about it. We wouldn't just get brushed off and say bye. So what do we do as good organizers? We put a petition together and put it on the web, change.org. And we got over 1,500 signatures on that petition. And then we had a meeting. We were invited to a meeting. And so we could have gone into this meeting with the righteous rage, right? Because what's happening is just historical. There is nothing new here. Y'all know that. As people who've been doing development work and anti-gentrification work for 20, 30 years, this is very normal. And so we had a lot of reason, you might say, to be angry, to be, what? And yet we went into this board meeting with the church's board with such poise, such power, such heart, such love. We invited a meditation at the beginning. We asked them to pray. We presented our proposal, and we all spoke from a place of love. We shared what our mission was. We said our mission is in line with your mission. It's just a different group of people. We invited them to be partners with us. And in that meeting, the board was so taken with our proposal. So this is where we went with faith. We had faith that if we negotiated from love, that they could feel us and hear us. And that in that moment of that 2.5 hour meeting, that would be an engagement of love. And that's exactly what happened. Their eyes opened up, yeah. They were with us. Maybe there wasn't perfect understanding. But in that moment, we engage as human beings. We try to leave the history, the context, as something that could inhibit us. But we acknowledge the history of why we, as Black and Brown bodies, should get this building and be in this community and do that work. So we didn't drop our history. We didn't drop truth, any of the truth. We came from heart. We acknowledged truth. And we were very powerful and solid. In that meeting, nothing came up about the petition, even though we had heard through the grapevine that the church was not happy with it, that we shouldn't have done that, that that was not negotiating in partnership. But this is normal as well, right? When people with power are challenged, they feel they should never be. That's why power stays there, right? So the meeting went well. lots of smiles and handshaking at the end of the meeting, and joy. And then later, as we're waiting for a decision, we get some feedback that the meeting was lovely, beautiful, but after the meeting, they felt that we were negotiating, we were making them negotiate from a place of fear. So we had some discussion of what love means, and it's not an anemic love, Dr. King. It's a strong, powerful love. But what we realized was that in that meeting, where we're coming from heart, it did something where they weren't even thinking about the petition and all that fear and animosity they had towards us. But after the meeting, when we were gone, and it was kind of back to, you know, business as usual, the history of unsettling, then it came back that we had actually used this petition as an organizing tool to invite a meeting so we could present ourselves. Especially when they wondered if we would offer an olive branch to show true negotiation, which we interpret as take the petition down, which we interpret with love as no, we're not. Because see, the petition came from a place of strength and love, was we deserve this, we want a meeting, we cannot just be ignored. The way it was received was from a place of fear. So there's a way where we don't have a responsibility for how a person responds to our love. We can do our best, we can come with love, and at some point we invite others to also be able to receive that. Before the meeting, they couldn't receive that because they hadn't engaged with us. During the meeting, they received it. They met us, they saw our hearts. You know, at the end, we prayed together. It was all there. But then when we left and they were by themselves again, they went back to that place of fear again. But what this shows is the power of love, the power of coming with faith and with power and with strength and compassion, right? So I'm a believer already, I have a lot of faith, but after that, it really even more solidified for me that when we meet fear and anxiety and anger as individuals and as collectives, like this example I just gave, that if there's a way that we can stay true to our practice, that something magical happens. So what happened in that room was magical. And that's all we can do, right? That's the equanimity part, is we do and then we leave it. So we left and we can't control, we can't go home with them and keep convincing them that we're love. But we can only do our best and we can keep doing that. And sometimes you have to let go what you can't control. And what our responsibility will always continue to be is to keep practicing from that space. We're clear, we're powerful, we're not letting go. And we continue to invite in partnership. So the invitation stays the same as the beginning. How do you meet your fears? How do you meet the violence that's out there in the homes, in the streets, in the workplace, in the school? But most importantly is how do you meet the violence in ourselves? Because it's how we respond to our spaces where we feel we're not quite sufficient. That is the training for how we respond outside when someone treats us the way they shouldn't. Remember yesterday I said the critique we have for others outside is really, it comes from the way we've learned to critique ourselves. So the invitation is to get in touch with our fears, get in touch with our anxieties, trace the line, and it's not often a linear line, it's a very jagged line. It goes off on its own history and comes back. Can we trace the lines when we're feeling impatient with ourselves? Can we go back and notice why? Where did it come from? And as we do that on that work of undoing that history in us, it will slowly allow us to undo the same history that we meet outside. Thanks for listening.
Friends, we have walking meditation at 11, so we have some time for a little break, some bathroom, have some drink, and then get your jackets, and we'll meet in the dining area, and then we'll practice walking outside.